Hey everyone, and welcome back to the First Act Podcast. This is part one on building, consolidating, and selling the entertainment industry with Summer Watson. Summer and I met at the Music Tectonics Conference back in October, where she was on a panel sharing her perspective on the future of the music and gaming business. With extensive background in the entertainment space, Summer shared with me a taste of her quest building a sustainable career in the arts. Personally, I was really curious to know more about how someone prioritized gaming in high school and then got accepted into Stanford and eventually helped sell a gaming company too, as she coins it, the mouse. Normally, I tell you all that this is an episode you don't want to miss, but this is an episode that I don't want to miss.
And now, hosted by Harry G, this is your one-stop shop for hot talk straight from the top. Whether you're trying to build a job in pop, rock, or any other artsy schlock, here's your top dog with info that can't be bought, it's gotta be sought. So sit back, crack a six-pack, because we're about to chit-chat and rip facts. It's the First Act Podcast.
I'm just going to introduce our guest for today. Summer Watson and I met at Music Tectonics, the conference back in October, where she was sharing her perspective on the future of music and gaming. With an extensive background in music and entertainment, Summer shared with me a little taste of her quest building a sustainable career in the arts. Personally, I was curious to know more about how somebody who prioritized gaming through high school got accepted to Stanford and eventually went on to sell a gaming company to, as actually Summer, as you coined it, the mouse. Normally I tell my audience that this is an episode you don't want to miss. I always do that like in the intro. And then this is an episode that I really don't want to miss. So I'm very excited for this interview. I know it was hard for us to kind of touch base and find the right date that worked. So I want to kind of start off by asking Summer, you, a couple questions right now. So what is your favorite album of all time and why?
Wow.
You have to pick one.
Okay. I know. I have so many. This one I'm going to say is going to sound a little bad because it's a little recent, but it has a special effect on me, which I'll say. So it's actually Daytona by Pusha T. Fairly recent, but it was released at a time when there was a lot going on. He and I together were releasing a new product called Air, mm-hmm. which, as you know, just releasing anything is a ton. And at the same time, the album was coming out, and people will remember there was a lot going on around that album release. That was when got into the biggest back and forth that he had ever had with Drake. Although it had quietly been going on for years, it just kind of exploded onto the scene then. And it was just, it was a lot behind the scenes. And so it was just a lot of noise around me. And that album was so focused and so surgical, for lack of a better word. It really helped me block out noise and help me focus. And to this day, my husband laughs. He says I'm psycho killer. If I really have a hard time sleeping, I can turn on Daytona and it just relaxes me. I think just because I know it so well, the sound is so cohesive and refined and focused, it just puts me at ease. And whether I need to hone in and think about something and really get a job done, or whether I need to just let my mind relax and wind down for the day, Daytona plays both roles for me. So I'll say final answer, Daytona, Pusha T.
You are going through to the $250,000 question. What is it on Millionaire? I completely botched
and
that.
and my handle online, although I lost it on Instagram, hope to get it back, is Surgical Summer, which is something he said, I want to say, three times in the kind of epic diss song that came out at that time. But it also, like I said, really, I think, describes him generally, but that album, like, just so precise, meticulous, surgical. So it also, you know, that time period lent my handle, my behind the scenes nickname. And at the time, so much information was embedded in that diss song. I got countless calls of people assuming I was the person who helped source the information. I was not. And it's become clear where that information came from. But yeah, there was just a lot wrapped up in that time period. And again, it both because that time period was so noisy and because of the sound itself, one producer, one MC, you know, a couple of features really tastefully integrated. It was just so focused. It really helps me focus.
Nice. Well, okay. So that's favorite album. What about favorite game?
Favorite game.
I know you're a big gamer, right?
I wouldn't say I'm a big gamer anymore, but I was a big gamer when I was younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. From the time I could coordinate my eyes and hands to play games, I played. My sister, I remember, had a console and I had a game that we both loved to play at the time. And we'd get into epic, you know, stare downs because I couldn't play the game without her console and she couldn't play the console without my game. And that was from a very young age. Then I got into PC games and probably if I had to pick my favorite game of all time, the one I've played the most, and that again was weaved into my own personal story and a very social time for me, I got really into Street Fighter II at arcades in high school. And eventually the clean version of the story that I tell people is I dropped out of high school playing too much Street Fighter II. It's not the whole story, but it's the clean version. And so, yeah, it's just been such a big part of my life. And again, there was like characters that I played in it that have become, you know, part of my backstory over the years. So Street Fighter II.
Nice. Are we going to hear the dirty story today or no?
It's not dirty, but no, there's a, you know,
explicit, there was, explicit version.
Yeah, it was a, it's we talk sometimes with my family. I'm the middle child. My older sister and my younger brother got into a ton of trouble growing up. My brother continues to struggle a bit. I never got in trouble, but I might have done way worse things than either of them. I just never got caught.
Nice.
So yeah, I was getting into a little trouble at the time. And at the same time, just, you know, was ready to leave the house and get on with my life. So I ended up leaving high school.
We'll revisit that. I have some questions. And if you're okay to share them, you know, you could always just be like, no, move
okay.
on.
Okay. Yep.
Okay.
With that oh. hand motion. No, no,
no. Yeah. You got to like judo chop, you know, some Street Fighter motions, right?
That's right. And then when I see you in LA, then I'll do it for real.
Yo, we should play Street Fighter 2. I have this thing called a sumo sis. It looks like...
Yep, I'm familiar.
You know it?
Yep.
Right here. Oh, get over here, you sumo
sis. You're going to fly with it?
Oh, yeah. I brought it. Corby and I played... Because, you know, it has like 10,000 games on it, right?
I'm ready.
I'm down to play Street Fighter 2 on there. Because I have like I have the remotes.
The original joysticks?
The SNES ones, not the original joysticks.
Okay.
So I'll have to
get a little used to that.
You'll be at a disadvantage, but I know how to use E-Honda really well.
I love that.
You know, mashing the
Yeah. There was, there was like very popular characters that most people used. I used Blanca, which
Blanca's
people hated,
great.
But I got very, I think, skilled with him. And E-Honda's another one that not many people use. So that'll be an interesting head-to-head.
I mean, I like how Street Fighter was to you. That was like Super Smash Bros. 64 to me. Like, that's like, I would use uncommon characters. I would go to find people on like Craigslist and like go to their houses and like play tournaments. And just like, I was a weird kid who just, I couldn't find people that were good enough, you know? Which I'm sure probably happened to you playing Street Fighter. At a certain point, you just get so much better than all your competition, no?
You were homegrown esports. I wouldn't say I got that good, but I was, you know, when I was skipping class and stuff, it's where I hung out with some of my friends at the time at the arcade. So we just had fun.
Were you at least the best fun. Among your friends?
For sure that, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But we were also there in the middle of the day when we probably shouldn't have been. So it was like us and the... guy that owned the arcade.
It's a good thing a lot of kids are listening in on the podcast, you know, because you're telling them, you know, don't go to the arcades.
They don't even know what an arcade is. Are you kidding me? Like, what is this lady talking about?
I used to go to the arcades to play. We had this place called Pinocchio's that was close to high school, and everyone would skip and go there. and I would go, I mean, I wouldn't skip. I was a huge nerd, but I would go during the lunch hours and I would play drums on they had like a drum game, kind of like Guitar Hero or like Rock Band, but like just drums.
Yep.
And they had like all like K-pop songs. Like it was all just like,
amazing. It was
like very upbeat, like kind of like DDR type songs. I didn't know any of the songs that we were playing on there, but I was just obsessed with learning how to play the drums and never had a drum kit at home. And so I would just do that. And so like, you know, if I were to skip class, like that's usually where I would go. So arcades were a big part, but I feel like they don't really exist much anymore. It's like each city has like two.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think they're also there. They can attract creepy people and things. So, you know, as a kid, I didn't think about it. But now if I had a kid, I wouldn't let them go without me.
Yeah.
But Rock Band, by the way, great game. I still have a Rock Band set at my house. So fun.
Love it. I was obsessed with Guitar Hero for a long time. I thought I invented it because I once said out loud to a friend. We were playing PlayStation 2, this game called Amplitude, which was like the PlayStation controller, and it had all like synth and drums and microphone and whatever. And you just had to hit like three buttons. It was like very, very simple Guitar Hero without the actual instrument. You'd use the remote and you'd build a track from hitting all the right notes for each instrument. And so I was saying to my friend, because I would play guitar, I was like, hey, we should, I wish there was a game that had a guitar and like the notes and we could play it. And then like 3 years later, it came out and I was like, I invented it. I was like, I put that out into the ether. I manifested it. And then we got Guitar Hero.
It's amazing. Just having been an entrepreneur for most of my life, how often that happens. And if you think about it, the time it took for them to build the game, they probably had the idea around the same time. Yeah. So it feels like we come in this moment where, for whatever reason, a certain idea starts to bubble up commonly. I'm actually going through this right now. There's an idea I've been playing with since October. And because of some of the things that have happened the last few months, I just haven't had time to focus on it. And in the past week and a half, I've come across three different teams. One that launched something similar, and two that are quietly building something similar. Like,
Do you want to talk about what it is, or is it not yet, but
I'd rather, yeah, it's a little premature.
Okay.
But it's going well. People are super excited about it. The engineer I have on it is amazing and just completely fired up. So I'm excited to test it out. You'll be one of the first people that sees it for sure.
I'm very excited. So which actually kind of pivots our conversation. You know, we've broken the ice. We know that you're more of a dogs person. You're an Aquarius. And we learned a little bit more. Now, I'm kind of curious, Summer, like, how would you define your role in entertainment?
That's a great question. So I think if I had to say, I'm a builder. So I love building people and teams and products that can reach masses and bring true moments of joy. I tend to not be afraid to be first or early on a trend or on an idea. And so that's made for some really, I think, captivating moments. Like, even if you think about, somebody was saying the other day, some of the reasons they were attracted to the Aku project included some of the, you know, partners and brands and talent that are affiliated with it. And they were not only just people who were really well aligned with each other and with the project, but they also were, in some cases, the audience was discovering them for the first time. So to me, that's like, even going back to high school, I was, you know, often the person introducing my peers and my friends to certain music that they hadn't heard before. And that was really fun for me. So I think identifying, you know, what can come next, it's not so much that you don't want to be so far ahead that you're not meeting people where they are, but to be, you know, right in the path of where they're heading and to be able to build something that reaches them and brings them, you know, whether it's moments of joy, moments of a break, and to do that with people and teams that I really can work well with. And, you know, that you think about the amount of time that you spend at work building those teams and the culture to be able to do these things in a meaningful and mass way. I know that was a lot of words, but if I had to summarize, build people and teams and products.
Great. And so you mentioned a lot of very interesting things there. And one thing that really stood out to me is that you've always sort of been ahead of the curve in, like, I guess before other people would get there. So you're saying, like, even as a kid, you'd discover music before your friends would, and then you would be the one kind of saying, hey, check this out. And so would these artists then go on to be big? Like, were you picking winners? Or it was like you were just picking things that you thought were winners?
I think both. I think it's also, you know, I came up in, at that time, by the time I was in high school, I was living in a suburb of Los Angeles that was predominantly white. I'm Black and Chinese. And I remember when we first moved there, my parents asked, how many other Black kids in your school? And I said, two and a half, if you count me. How many Asian kids are three and a half, if you count me? Like, that sort of, you can really count. And so I think, you know, it's another place where I maybe brought in music that was popular in other communities, just wasn't quite yet in ours, you know. So, and I would also say it depends on, you know, what you count as winners. To me, it's just, you know, if you do great work that will be remembered and cherished by people, that to me is a win. I don't think, like I just said, right, one of my favorite albums of all time is Pusha T's Daytona. And Push has this 20 plus going on 20 year career, and may have not had all of the, you know, super pop stardom heights of some of his peers, but he's built quite a lucrative career and is leaving a legacy of high quality work. And I think, to me, that's a win. It's a huge win. So yeah, I think at the time in high school, it varied, you know, everything from like things that I consider pretty well known, EPMD, to like, you know, Hieroglyphics and Souls of Mischief, which were probably pretty big in the Bay Area at the time, but we were in the suburbs of LA. So for some of my friends, it was the first time they were hearing it. And I would say those are winners for sure. Another set of people that have been able to make a really long-standing career and build a real engaged community around them for decades.
And so what would you do to find these, you know, these hidden gems? You said that these things were coming out in the Bay Area. Most of your friends were in LA. Like, you know, if you were, I guess, a kid or a teenager, like, how were you putting yourself, like, what kind of situations were you putting yourself in that you were the nucleus?
Yeah, I'd say two things. One, radio was a really big thing at the time. So college radio, and there was a culture of passing around tapes. So I remember the first time I heard the Wu-Tang Clan, it was, I don't even know who it came from, but it was clear somebody had recorded it from a radio station in New York, and it somehow made its way out to, you know, the quote unquote underground community on the West Coast. So that's one. There was definitely a culture of, you know, tapes, and then as time went on, vinyl. I became a DJ and would spend a lot of time digging in the crates at Amoeba and Rasputin's up when I was in college in the Bay Area, and then meeting other DJs and sharing information with each other. And the second thing I'd say, which has continued to be a theme in my life, and I think why I've been able to work on such a variety of interesting things, is I've always been open to getting to really building deep relationships with people in lots of different kinds of communities. So even in high school, I wasn't contained to the people I was going to high school with. In fact, the people that I spent the most time with were not at my high school. In particular, there was a group of people that I spent a lot of time with who were also huge music nerds at the time. We all went to different high schools. And so we just had these, you know, lack of a better word, decentralized friend groups. And we were tied together, not by growing up together, or living in the same neighborhood, but having similar interests. So I think that network of people who loved similar music as me, we just shared with each other. And that's probably how I eventually got, you know, a tape that had Eminem from Detroit, and someone described it as, hey, here's this white rapper from Trailer Park in Detroit. That's how he was first described to me. You know, that's how I first heard him. It was literally on a cassette tape. So just that, I think being open to different people from different walks of life, and for me being all about, I'm always looking to stay outside and get inspiration and exposure to things, as many things in the world as I can, and ideally things that aren't assumed to be for me, right? I've gotten involved in Web3 and crypto the last few years. And one of the things that I talk a lot with people that's exciting is we're now, you know, not having to necessarily, even just from a marketing perspective, I think there's a lot that comes from traditional marketing in terms of trying to understand people's demographics, make assumptions based on those demographics, and target people based on those demographics. And I, for one, have never been one that fit into most of the demographic definitions that people would define, and most of my friends wouldn't either. But now with crypto, what we're seeing is not trying to figure out a proxy for what people are going to want, but we actually get exposure to their wallets. And as we have more and more meaningful use cases that people are buying digital assets or digital representations of physical goods that they're buying, you know, it may be anonymous, but it's actual data based on what they're spending their time and their money on. And we're not having to make guesses based on what does a 17-year-old girl from the suburbs interested in. I promise you that what you were assuming probably wasn't true, because I was playing Street Fighter 2 and listening to rap.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. It's really turning the whole marketing game on its head, and it allows for people to be anonymous because all you really care about is certain spending habits. It doesn't really matter what their ethnic background is, how old they are, what gender they are, right? Like, so instead of targeting,
and certainly not my name, phone number, or my email, hopefully. But yeah,
exactly. And I'm very excited about what's to come in the Web3 space. I know that that's sort of where we got to bond a little bit and talk about what's coming there. I want to stay on track. So my main question here right now is, so you left school, we'll say to play Street Fighter 2. And then how did you, and at what age did you end up back in college? Did you go straight to college or did you work for a little bit first? You mentioned you were a DJ. I kind of want to get a bit of a timeline. I want to figure out, you know, what your path was to really breaking into this space.
Yeah, so I didn't get a high school degree, but I was doing well in high school. I was definitely at the top of the class, still in touch with the valedictorian from high school, and she swears up and down that if I hadn't left, she would have been the salutatorian. So I did well. And so the teachers knew me, the college counselor knew me. And I'd gone to the college counselor at one point and said, you know, I think I'm done. And she said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm not sure, but USC had reached out with, they had this program. I don't know if they still have it, but at the time they would let high school seniors start college early. So you'd spend the equivalent of your high school senior year at USC. And then they would work with your high school to get your high school degree so that the circle was completed. And I told her that seems like a good idea. It was still not too far from home, but it was not home. And she said, well, let me talk to a friend of mine. He's a dean at Pitzer College, which was one of the Claremont colleges in the same town that I grew up in. And yeah, she had a great conversation with him. And he said, just apply here, apply to both and see what you think. Their thinking, I think, was that a smaller liberal arts college environment would be an easier transition for someone out of high school rather than being dropped right in the middle of the city at USC.
Right.
And so did that and got in. And so I actually ended up going straight from high school to college. I just didn't get the high school degree. My college counselor tried to help me talk to the school about it, and they just were sort of like, well, if you want to be out. We're not going to do any favor. So I technically don't have a high school degree, but I did spend the next year in college. And right away decided I would always loved math. I wanted to be a math major, and found out quickly that Pitzer at the time had two math classes. One was calculus, which I'd taken in high school. And the other was something called the Mathematical Mystery Tour, which was a nod to a Beatles album, which was awesome. But decided, you know, that this might not be the place. And so I filled out an application to transfer to Stanford and got in, went to Stanford the next year.
Wow.
And also got to get further away from home. From there,
studied math, right? You studied computers and math, something like that.
Yeah. So I studied math and computer science at Stanford. So you'll see I have like this kind of tendency to sit in multiple worlds at once, if that makes sense. And even in high school, the high school I went to was this private boarding school. I was a day student, but it was technically a boarding school. Most of the students were from all over the world. college prep. Like everybody that went to our school got into some college. It was a pretty, I was doing the things that you're supposed to do, but I also had this group of friends that either were going to a different high school, or frankly, some of them had dropped out already. Some of them were getting into trouble. And so I just have both of my feet.
So, sorry to interrupt, but your parents
were me leaving high school.
Yeah. You probably get that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I'm definitely my father's daughter, which is headstrong, and hard to like, my husband will laugh. My parents and my husband will laugh all the time. So people will be like, you let Summer XYZ, like there's no letting Summer do anything. It's just Summer's going to do what she's going to do. So, they've always been supportive, but they also just know my personality, and I think they trust me to make the best decisions for my life. And as long as I can take care of myself, they're good. And so far, so good.
It's incredible. That's really great. And
yeah, they're great. I even younger, I remember I have memories of just, you know, one day saying I wanted to be an astronaut, another day saying I wanted to be the team doctor for the Lakers, another week saying I wanted to be a writer. My mom really wanted me to be a writer, which is an unusual thing for a parent to want to encourage, I think. And every time, no matter what I said I wanted to do, the answer was along the lines of, okay, great, let's figure out how that gets done. And like making me really think through what it is I want to do and what it would take to get there, rather than saying, oh no, you have to decide, or oh no, that's too hard. And so essentially to go figure out the information and see if that's, you know, a path that I'm willing to do the work for. And like I said, my dad was a doctor, so I saw how hard that was. Ultimately decided, I don't think I had, you know, you can see I probably have a little bit of ADD in me, that I wasn't sure that I could do the like 7 to 12 years of school and then the one thing for the rest of my life. But there was a time that I thought I wanted to, and they definitely encouraged that and, you know, let me work at his office to see what it was like every day. So yeah, they've always been really supportive to this day they are.
So when you told me a little while back when I was sick that you can refer me to one of the top ENTs in LA, was that for your dad?
It's the doctor who my dad. My dad's retired now, but yeah.
Okay.
So there's actually, it's interesting. There's, they would tell the story better. And one of these days I want to sit them down and try and get it down. But there was a period of time when my dad and a group of people that I now know as his friends were all Black doctors studying to be ENTs. And so there ended up being this really small group of Black ENTs. And they all will tell you that after that, there basically just isn't another generation of them. So it's really interesting. There's maybe one generation after them, and then not very many since. So it's this small club. They all know each other. Push actually he lives in Virginia. And at the time he lived in Maryland, kind of the DC area. And he had gone to an ENT who was a pretty high profile ENT out that way. I forget. I think he's the head of, I'm going to get it wrong, but he's a, you know, prominent ENT out there, and he's a Black ENT. And so when Push went in, he said, oh, one of my friends' dad is a Black doctor who also specializes in ENT. And he said, oh, what's his name? He gave him the name. He said, I know him.
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't know each other. But so this doctor was one generation after my dad. But he said, I know him. I know of him. And the doctor who trained him also trained me. It's just a tiny world. So there's this interesting story.
So niche. I think.
Yeah, it's like, it's a niche specialty. They were all becoming doctors in the 70s. So, wasn't a ton of even Black people in medical school at the time. So it's a pretty interesting, I think, group of people. It's a story that I'd like to hear more about and help tell someday. But yeah, that's where the ENT reference came from.
Well, when you learn the whole story, I want to hear more about it.
Thanks for tuning in to part one. Stay tuned for part two. Remember, new episodes release every Thursday at 12 p.m. Pacific. See you there.